This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss Cowain. If you had seen my guest, Lionel Aldrich, out on the street 6 years ago, you would have seen a paranoid, delusional, homeless person. If you were a football fan and had looked more closely, you might have recognized the great defensive lineman who played with the Green Bay Packers during their heyday in the 60s when they won the first two Super Bowls. Aldrich retired from football in 1973 and began working as a sports broadcaster in Milwaukee and as an analyst for NBC Sports. But within a year, he had a psychotic episode. He was hospitalized and diagnosed as schizophrenic. During the next 12 years, Aldrich was in and out of hospitals. There were times when he held down a job, but he eventually ended up on the street, broke. In 1986, some friends convinced him to go back into the hospital. This time he agreed to take medication and began to get well. Aldrich now makes his living as a public speaker, offering a glimpse inside the world of mental illness. He came to Philadelphia in October to speak at a program sponsored by the Albert Einstein Medical Center and the Philadelphia Psychiatric Center. Aldrich told me that he couldn't point to anything earlier in his life that would indicate he'd become mentally ill.
My early symptoms started in 1974, and that's the first part of my life that where I could actually say that, yeah, this was something that led to what I'm, you know, currently experiencing.
What were some of those early symptoms?
Initially, I became very suspicious of people, very paranoid, thinking people were talking about me, looking at me, and saying things about me and out to get me somehow. I had difficulty concentrating. I had trouble completing tasks on time. I couldn't keep up with the clock, you know.
Literally, and, I mean, right. a clock on the wall.
Absolutely. Yeah, I just couldn't keep up with... I had regular responsibilities, and I was just falling behind all the time and always in a panic to get things done.
What did you say to yourself was going on?
I knew there was something wrong. So I got myself into a therapy program, which, you know, at that time it was not embarrassing or anything like that to get into therapy because we had just come out of the 60s when everyone either had a therapist or a guru. So I got into a therapy program in 74, figuring this was something that could be corrected by a competent therapist and I'd be back as good as new in no time. But what happened is soon after getting into therapy, some months after that, I had what's called a psychotic break, which is a complete break with reality. I went crazy, and I had to be hospitalized, and that was the beginning of it.
What did friends say to you, and did people notice what was going on with you, or could you keep some of this anxiety and turmoil inside of you?
Well, I kept a great deal of it inside of me, but I became very difficult to be around. I was almost impossible to work with, so I was a problem for people who had to be in my company, and especially people who worked with me. That became real strained, and I'm sure it wasn't very pleasant for them, but I became kind of a problem to be with, you know.
Did people say to you, Lionel, that there's something going on here? What's upsetting you, or what's going on?
They didn't say those things, but they thought them, you know, and they didn't say them until after I had to blow up, and then they could look back and say, yeah, that wasn't very much like him, you know.
Did you feel then rather alone in all this?
I felt completely alone once I had to admit that I had a mental illness. It suddenly took me out of the group that I was in and placed me in a place all by myself. Once you have to say that, you know, some people have a problem with the word crazy, and I don't know whether I should say that or not, but I personally don't have a problem with that, so it's comfortable for me. In fact, I think we should say that word until people do become comfortable with it. So once you say that I'm crazy, you immediately separate yourself out from the population that you've been with, and it is very much alone. You're like you're on the outside looking in.
Tell us about your breakdown, your psychotic break. What actually happened?
Okay. My break occurred. I was at home when the first bizarre thing happened. I was interested in making some personality changes. I had just come through a football career, and I wanted to take the guy who played football and fix him up, dress him up, and bring him to town, you know, clean him up, and, you know, get all of the aggression out of him. So I was interested in making some changes. So I was reading a lot of what we call head books.
Kind of self-improvement books.
Yeah, self-help books. And I was reading a book called Flight of the Eagle. And one of the things that it suggested was that, you know, to know something, you should ask yourself. And I followed that and asked myself, and I answered. At least something answered in me. And that was the beginning of my hearing voices. And that was very frightening. So later on that day, I was sitting down at the dinner table, and the voice said, look at your food. So I looked down at my plate, and it turned into a plate of worms. You know, so that scared me. I jumped up and ran out. So this upset the whole family and everything. They didn't know what was happening to me. I suddenly became very scary to them. And that was just a couple of things. There were some other bizarre stuff. The next day, it was during the winter, so I ran barefoot through the snow to my car and went looking for my therapist because she was the only person that I trusted, and I wanted to find her. And I went to the place where we had our meetings normally, and it was all locked up because it was a day when no one was there. So while I was out, I started imagining or thinking that my wife was a witch, and now I couldn't come home, you know, because I thought she was somehow doing some things to me. So I spent the night out, and the next day, my therapist found out what was happening with me and came, and I came home. And somehow we got together, and she suggested that I go to the hospital, that this was a safe place for me, and it was a place where I could be protected and taken care of. And I believed her, so I went.
When you say that you looked down at your plate one day, mm-hmm. and the voice told you to look down, and this meal became a plate of worms, you mean that. I mean, you mean that what you saw was a plate of worms.
Yeah, it was a hallucination, and that was exactly what I saw. You know, that means simply meant I would see things that nobody else would see. Like another day, I looked at a bunch of balloons. You know those long balloons that people twist into little animals and things and that are real cute for kids? I had little kids at that time, and I had a bunch of those laying on the floor. They were blown up. And while I was looking at them, they all turned into snakes. Yeah, it was just the way my hallucinations ran, and I had not hallucinated before, and I found that very frightening. It took me years to get comfortable with the hallucination.
Well, especially I would think with hallucinations of snakes and worms. I mean, things that many people are frightened of anyway.
Yeah, I've been sitting in. I spent about 2 years or so on the street. And I recall one time I was in Florida, in Jacksonville, and I was sitting in a restaurant. I just sold, my car. This was kind of the beginning of my street experience. I just sold my car, so I had some money, and I went to a restaurant. And the waitress came with my plate, and it was a plate of maggots. You know, and I could hear people in the restaurant. I was hearing voices from people in the restaurant, you know, and people that were not there also. But, it took you have to exercise some kind of control in that situation because you're completely on your own, you know. So at that point, I began to try to exercise some control over this and not be frightened by it. So in my mind, I imagined myself moving these things off of my plate so I could go ahead and eat my food. So, you know, I had many meals like that where I would eat around what I was seeing on my plate, where my food would come and it would be alive, it would be moving, you know. So the experience of being mentally ill can be very, very frightening to a person if you are not aware of what hallucinations are like.
Could your family have helped you at that point? I mean, if your family had known that that plate was, for you, a plate of worms, could they have said something to you which would have calmed you down?
I don't think so. Because this is my reality at this point. You know, it's a reality that I share with no one. But to me, it is very real. There is nothing, this doesn't look like an imagining or imagination. This is real to me. So I doubt if there's anything they could have done other than maybe take me to a hospital. That would have been the best thing that anyone could have done for me.
So no one could have offered you another reality? I mean, at that point it said...
Absolutely not. They could not have offered me another reality. Forget it completely. Don't even think of offering me another reality because this one is too real for me to deny.
What did you say to yourself, or how did you explain to yourself then what was going on? Did you think you were being punished for something? I mean, to be frightened by things that we just live with day to day.
At one time, I thought I was in trouble with God, which is kind of a typical thing for people who become mentally ill. They think they've somehow done something and are being punished. Well, I thought I was in trouble with God, and I was somehow being punished because the books I had been reading... See, I was raised Christian, and the books I had been reading were on Eastern religions, and I thought I had somehow fallen in disfavor with God as a result of reading those books.
What did the voices tell you? And were there several voices, or was there one voice that you heard that spoke to you?
Over the course of the years, there are many voices. And at the same, you know, like they were telling me that I was a genius, things like this. These were early things, you know. And I was, I would write down things on notepads that made absolutely no sense to anyone else, but I thought that they were somehow brilliant and should be, this was something the world had been waiting for, and I was somehow leading the population and responsible for all these people. So there's a tremendous amount of pressure connected with that, you know, and the responsibility, yeah.
Were there moments of clarity? I mean, moments when the hallucinations died down?
I would have moments where I would just clear up completely, but then I would just snap right back into it again. I couldn't control when I was clear and when I wasn't. So it would just happen at various times, and I would make complete sense. Everything would be fine. Everyone would think I was okay. Then a thought or something would occur, and I would be right back into it again.
Was there any kind of safety net? And you talk about being on the streets for 2 years, but here you are, a successful football player, a mm-hmm. successful sportscaster, mm-hmm. someone that we think of has some kind of safety net, has some kind of security under him, and yet there you were. You found yourself on the streets.
Yeah, there was really nothing under me. I got sick in 74. I continued to work until 1981. And by 81, my wife, because of the illness, had started divorce proceedings. So when I took a leave of absence from the job in 74, and I had to get out of the house as part of the divorce proceedings. So I threw some clothing and other things into the car and started driving around the country. I was, in effect, pretty alone at that point, you know, because there was no one I could discuss this with. How do you go and say that, you know, who do you talk to about this, you know? And so I started driving around the country and eventually wind up, when all my money ran out, I wound mm-hmm. up on the street.
If we had passed you on the street, what would we have seen?
If you had passed me on the street at that time, you you probably would not have noticed that there was anything wrong with me, because I wasn't exhibiting any kind of bizarre physical behavior. If you had seen me at certain times, you would have seen me walking backwards on the street. This is a little later on. You would have seen me walking flat-footed, making sure that the flat part of my foot landed flatly on the ground.
Important to you?
Oh, yes. This was like some kind of a maze or some kind of a program that I had, a problem that I had to solve in order to regain sanity. You would have seen me not stepping on any of the cracks between the sidewalks and things like that. But so that's not really terribly bizarre. I mean, someone may see me walking like that and simply think I had a physical problem.
Right.
And if they saw me walking backwards, they would probably think that was a little bizarre. But I did all of those things while I was out there.
You mentioned being hospitalized. And how were you able to kind of slip through the network, I guess, of community organizations? I mean, people who are charged to take care of people who have mental illness.
This was in 1974, you know, and we weren't doing a great deal at that time for the mentally ill. They've learned a tremendous amount about what to do about people like me since then. But at that time, there wasn't, you know, in fact, they called it a nervous breakdown.
Right.
Because I was known in the community, my illness got publicized in the paper. But my doctor said to me, I remember him saying this to me very clearly. He says, by the time I finish with the paperwork, you know, when you get out of the hospital here, he said, this will look like a common cold. So anyway, he was trying to conceal it in some way to help me. So I wouldn't be bothered by that later on. So I had the attitude that I was going to completely recover from a nervous breakdown. I just figured, well, I've been working too hard, you know, and I need to slow down a bit and take it a little easy. But and thinking that it would get better, but it just got worse. It didn't get better.
How bad did it get? And I assume that living on the streets is probably just about as bad as it gets.
That's as low as it can get. It can't get any lower than that. I mean, you're the absolute bottom of this country if you're living on the street. And I was out there for a couple of years. My whole effort while I was there was trying to find a way off. And what I found out while I was there is you can't get off the street by yourself. You got to have help to get off.
How did you get help then?
Well, my route back was through the hospital. I came back to Wisconsin and went to a place that I had been in business with this man and this family. And they took me to the hospital and got me checked in after some, you know, doings, and I agreed to go. And that was the best thing, again, that could have happened to me. This was my second, third hospitalization, actually, in 1984, 10 years after I first got sick. And it was that hospitalization in 1984 where I started to recover.
Well, what were they able to do that they weren't able to do 10 years before that time?
Well, one of the things they were able to do was get me to go. You know, like, I simply would not take the medication.
Well, part of your hallucination, and that somehow it was going to hurt you?
No. When I was hospitalized the first time, I took medication and it worked, and I got out of the hospital. But when I got out of the hospital, I wouldn't take it anymore because I was a sports announcer. And whenever I took the medication, it slowed me down so much I couldn't talk. And I had to talk. You know, so I figured I was better off of it than I was on it. And I knew I had a problem, and I would just watch myself manage me and take care of me and keep me out of trouble. And in 81, I did that. I was able to do it that way. But, you know, I was very paranoid. It was the hardest thing I've ever done. You know, walking away from that job and losing it all was not as hard as sitting there and performing it on the air every night, being paranoid.
Yeah. And so in the third hospitalization, then, in a sense, you'd come to the point where you realized that...
I, in effect, had given up and accepted treatment. I had tried everything to help myself and had been unable to. Mm-hmm. So I accepted treatment. I took the medication. I started telling people that I was going to give the medication a chance. This is other people in the hospital with me. And as it had before, the medication worked. The hallucination stopped. The voices stopped. The paranoia was beginning to subside. And I got really excited about the possibility of getting well and started looking for what I could do to help myself in addition to what the medication was doing.
Did you feel, going into the hospital on the third try, that somehow you had failed? I mean, that you had failed on your own to control what it was you were dealing with?
I had been unable to do it. That's right. I had been unable to do it on my own. Every hospitalization I've had, I saw as a failure mm-hmm. in me to solve this. My last hospitalization, my eighth one, was a little over a year ago during the summer. And when I left that one, I felt I had finally solved it. I felt I feel in my own heart that I have finally collected and accumulated enough information on this illness that I can now keep myself out of the hospital.
And the illness you have is schizophrenia, is that
paranoid
right?
Paranoid schizophrenia, yeah.
What kind of medication
do you take? Haldol. In 84, when I was hospitalized, I was on 35 milligrams. Since that time, I have been down as low as one. I currently take 2 milligrams. And at the end of October, which is a very busy month for me on the circuit, my doctor that I see once a month is going to lower it to 1 milligram again. So I'm taking a very low dose, and I'm able to stay symptom-free on this small amount.
Are there side effects? Are there things?
There are side effects of the medication, which makes it, you know, taking it unattractive. Mm-hmm. Then you have to take another medication for the side effect, and that medication also has side effects. So I was glad to get with a doctor who believed in a minimal amount of medication and was willing to work with me to get it down.
You say you've been hospitalized 8 times. Mm-hmm. Was the sort of precipitating event the fact that you would stop taking the medication, or that the dose was so low that it really wasn't providing what it was that you needed?
Well,
I mean, once having sort of come face to face with what you're
feeling. I understand what you're asking. And my answer to that is that there is a great deal more going on with the illness than what the medication does. It once took 35 milligrams to stabilize me. I can remember hallucinating on 6 milligrams. I currently take 2 and I'm not having any symptoms at all. So, in some of the hospitalizations, at least one of them, it was because I wasn't taking the medication. And others, it was because I was allowing things like negative thinking and insecure thinking to simply expand and become a real problem for me and land me back in the hospital.
How do you control your mind? And what do you do? What can you say
to
yourself?
That's exactly what you do, is control your mind. This is a sick... a sick mind is what the person has who has this illness. And the mind is something that you can control. But it takes a while to learn that. You know, first of all, you may go years without even knowing that it's possible. So most of us who live with the illness live as victims of our mind. We do what our mind tells us to do. We don't know that it can be done the other way around, which is to be selective in your thought process. Choose the thoughts that you want to have and those that you'd like to expand and be a part of your life. And, you know, so you take unattractive thoughts and you stop those and you start thoughts that you want, those that are good for you and those that helped you. And that's what I do. In the beginning, it takes a little work to get it going, and it takes some vigilance on your part to make it happen for yourself. But after a certain amount of time, it becomes very simple. It becomes as mindless as living the other way does. Yeah. You know? So it's a very neat thing.
And so you can really, at this point, recognize a destructive thought or a thought.
Absolutely. Well, a destructive thought, an example of a destructive thought would be sitting here thinking that you were somehow being dishonest with me and becoming paranoid about what your real purpose is in this interview, and that you were somehow giving information on me to people that I was unaware of, so they would know something about me that I didn't know.
So you could entertain that.
Yes. I could. Right now, I could have that thought if I wanted to. But I know better than that. I choose better than that. I don't want that kind of difficulty in my life. So if that thought comes up, I stop it.
Would you say there's any shame in having to be, if you have to be hospitalized then in a couple of years or next summer or something, is there any shame in that for you?
There's no shame in it. What's in it is I would feel like I had failed and would have to start all over again. I would feel real badly about that, and I would have to get over feeling bad about it and start anew with some new kind of program.
Why do you think the myths about mental illness persist? And we do know more about the causes of mental illness, and I think we are less blaming of families and mothers and mm-hmm. others who have been blamed in the past. But there still are fears, misconceptions that seem to survive through all the kind of new scientific evidence.
Yeah, and I think they survive because people don't have the facts about it. They really don't know. They tend to see people, they don't tend to see us as people once we become ill. They just get involved in their own fears regarding us. I think fear is probably the biggest culprit, the biggest hindrance to change. If people were not afraid, they would certainly react differently to us, and they would spread and cause something to spread that would be different than what we're getting now. I think fear is a real problem for us and one of the main causes of us being misunderstood.
What do you think people are afraid of?
Well, I don't think they really know. I don't think what they're afraid of is clear, which makes it even worse. You know, if they were able to identify, they could resolve it a lot quicker. But I think one of the things that they find frightening is that some of us do commit violent acts at various times. But what they don't know is that we don't commit those acts at any higher rate than the normal population. But every time they hear that a mentally ill person was involved in some violent act, the natural connection their mind makes is that all mentally ill people are somehow given to violence. And that's something they do, I think, by being a bit mindless about our situation at that time. If they knew that we don't do that at any higher rate than healthy people, if they knew how nice we were, if they knew how afraid of them we are, if they knew how afraid we are of them, I think they would see us and react differently to us.
Well, I thank you for your honesty with
us
today. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Marnie.
My guest has been Lionel Aldridge. He was a defensive lineman for the Green Bay Packers in the 60s. Aldridge is a public speaker now, talking about his experiences with mental illness.